And we are live. Welcome to episode 3765. It is going to be the last episode of November, I believe. I'm not actually sure if when we come back on Monday, it will be December. It will be December. The calendar does not lie. I will, of course, shut down for Thanksgiving like I always do. Tomorrow you'll get the Thanksgiving special show that goes all the way back to 2008. It's only about 22 minutes long. It's called The Survivalist View of Thanksgiving. Today, we're going to kind of go old school as well. We're not going to go super old school, but we are going to go, you know, kind of to the basics. This show is going to be 12 questions about preparedness answered by me. And these questions are a mix of questions that I've received many times over the years. Some of those I've received from you guys, from the audience, from people that actually watch the show that I would call the initiated, right? And then some of these questions are questions that I get more from the mainstream public when they find out what I do and what I'm all about. Like if I'm at a friend's house party or something like that, and you start having conversations with people who don't really know you. They just know you through the friend or the family member. They're like, well, what do you do? Well, I'm a podcaster. And I try not to evangelize at things like that. But if they ask, I'll tell them, I do a show called Survival Podcast of Preparedness. And first question we're going to hit today is, but why should I bother to prep? Where I live is boring. Nothing happens. Keep in mind that I live in North Texas, which is one of the tornado touchdown capitals of the world. So that's an interesting thing for that person to say, not to mention hailstorms, not to mention 3 years ago, the big Texas freeze, not to mention many winter storms that have completely shut things down. Around. You see what I'm saying? I think these people are generally in the mindset of what? End of the world as we know it. I just turned a guest down with that, building your food pantry for the end of the world as we know it. And it wasn't just shtick. It wasn't just we talk about fighting the zombies because if you're ready for the zombies. She was serious. And I'm like, not my thing, man. This is not what we do. We teach practical everyday preparedness. We don't hinge on either apocalypse or nothing. So I'm going to hit that question and 11 other ones when we get started. I did want to tell you guys a story real quick, though. I've always found this funny about my granddaughter, Tegan. I guess she's like 9 now. So this is probably when she's about 6. It's probably 2-3-ish years ago, maybe a little further back. We're talking, still at that stage where Santa is a big thing for a little kid, And she happened to ask my wife, Dorothy, Grandma, what is your favorite holiday? And this was about a week before Thanksgiving. And, of course, you got Thanksgiving and Christmas coming up and all the other holidays of the year. But, of course, the kids focused on Christmas. Well, my wife tells her, honey, I think Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. Not only did she disagree, now come on, she's a little girl, don't be hard on her. She cried. She was so upset that Grandma liked Thanksgiving better than Christmas. I love Christmas. I have to say, and the reason this is coming up is somebody here in the chat, who was it? Jay Hosk says, who else has Thanksgiving as their favorite holiday of the year? It is my favorite holiday of the year. And I'll tell you why. I generally don't have to go anywhere. Thanksgiving's usually at my house. In fact, we usually do Thanksgiving on Friday. Because there's all these family conflicts and we might go off to somebody's place, but in general, we stay home. I get to cook, which I love to do. Don't have to go anywhere. It's not like Christmas and your family's pushing you to go to church or something like that. You don't have to put on a monkey suit, a suit and tie, or any of that shit. You don't have to worry about what you're buying anybody for a Christmas. Not that I mind giving gifts, but I don't have to think about it. It's the ultimate dude holiday. Just think about this from, tomorrow you hear the actual history of Thanksgiving, right? And the survival mindset that goes with it. But let's imagine there isn't a Thanksgiving, right? I know this is off topic, but I thought this would be fun today since Jay said that. Imagine there is no Thanksgiving and you're trying to come up with a new holiday and you want to pitch it to guys. Okay? That's your goal. You're pitching a holiday to men. And they say, so what's going to happen? We're going to schedule this holiday and it's going to be so loved that almost every business is going to do it. You're going to have Thursday off, which means most businesses are also going to give you Friday off. And even if they don't, you take one PTO day, one vacation day, and you get a 5-day weekend. Okay. All right. We have a great big sale the Monday after it. And the Friday after, so your wives can go shopping on Friday and leave you alone. And on Monday, you can buy the shit you didn't go out to buy. Tell me more. What do we do on this holiday? Well, you know, you cook a great big pile of food, turkey, roast beef, ham, whatever you want, your main course, maybe multiples. Okay. Is there going to be alcohol? Funny you should ask. It's actually going to be expected by anybody that shows up for this holiday that there will be alcohol. If you don't have it, people are going to be upset. You're going to have it. And since many people might come over, you're going to have wine, beer, and spirits so that everybody's happy. Well, okay, so when do we eat? We eat at like 6 o'clock? No. We're going to get this out early. Like, people are going to show up around noon. You're going to eat around 2 o'clock, somewhere in that range. But you can be flexible a little later, a little earlier. It's all up to you. Well, what are we going to eat under this main course? Oh, potatoes and gravy, maybe some vegetables, but you can put bacon on the green beans and whatever else you want. Okay, so then we're going to eat this big meal, so we're going to be really full, right? So then what's next? Oh, dessert. So we better go easy on the food. No. There's something to do in between dessert and dinner. We'll get to that in a second. Well, here's what you're going to have for dessert, though, like pumpkin pie, apple pie, ice cream with it, whatever anybody can come up with, really. Like all of the dessert you can eat, right? Okay. But like you said, all this just giant meal, like what are we going to do next? Like between dinner and we're going to put football on Thursday. Wait a minute. Wait, football? Yeah, football. And it's going to be completely acceptable for all the guys to sit in front of the TV and watch football and be left alone while they do it. So these are going to be like, you know, second-rate teams. No, they're going to be some of the most beloved teams in the country that we're going to put on. Two games for you. What? Two football? Yes, and you're allowed to watch them both. And then what happens? Well, after you have you watch some football and all, you take a nap. Wake up, have another drink, and eat dessert. You take another nap. Wake up, hang out with your family. Then everybody goes home or everybody goes to bed. Okay, do I have to go to church for this? Nope. Do I have to get dressed in any real special way for this? Nah. Nah, we put your pants on. Can't do it in your boxers. Pants, shirt, shoes optional, but it'd be better if you put shoes on. I'm in, right? I'm in. That is the freaking holiday of men. Thanksgiving is a holiday of men. Big, giant food, family around you, good drink, football on the TV, no obligation to go anywhere except if you're going to somebody's house that is hosting it, and then it's your choice to go. I'm in. It's my favorite holiday. Anyway, that is not what we're here to talk about today. We're going to answer 12 prepping questions. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is Start9 Private Servers. If you get yourself a Start9 server and follow the instructions and install it, you're going to be able to do all kinds of really cool things, like run truly private end-to-end encrypted messaging for you and your friends only in a completely anonymous manner. You're going to be able to run your own node for Bitcoin, your own Lightning node for Bitcoin payments over Lightning. You're going to be able to do just a huge variety of things. You're going to have this reality going on. You will manage and control your own online destiny, including how you access files from across the internet. You can do that completely. In fact, it's required. You're going to do it completely encrypted over something called Tor. If this all sounds intimidating, don't let it be. You can do this. Anybody can do this. If you can install and configure apps on your phone, then you can do this. Check it out today. Start9 Private Servers. Remember, they do a 9% discount for MSB members, which on the more expensive of the two options with the servers will pay for your membership for like 3.5-4 years. Especially since we're on sale right now for the MSB, it's only $35. We're talking more like 5 years of your membership covered if you're going to get a Start9 server. So that'd be a good reason to pick one up. Next up today is KnifeKits.com. KnifeKits is not the first company that ever sponsored the Survival Podcast. And this is a lot of years now. We're going back. I started the show 17 plus years ago now. They are either the second or the third sponsor that I signed. It was definitely Safe Castle was first, and then it was either Knife Kits or the Berkey guy after that. And I don't know which one came first, the knife or the Berkey. But it's absolutely the case that these guys have been around since the very beginning. They're still sponsoring the show. I didn't take sponsors till my second year, so that's 16 years the Knife Kits has been sponsoring this podcast. Lots of great ideas for Christmas gifts over there. Knife Kits is a company that does what it says and says what it does. You can go buy kits that you can assemble into a knife. You can put a lot of customization into it, but anybody can do it, even me. It's not hard. They make it easy. But if you're at a different level, and you're above the kit level, they also have the raw materials, Damascus steel, buffalo horn, mammoth tusks. They also have all the stuff you could need for like holsters and sheaths, like kydex and leather components as well. Check them out today at knifekits.com, and they do do a discount for MSB members as well. It's a rather small discount, but they're working on small margins, so that's what they can do. They do it more to support the show and the audience than anything else. With that, let's get on into this. And as I said, these are questions that have come to me from many different angles, some directly from this audience and because of what I do and social media and things like that, and some just from people that I meet and discussion goes to a point where they find out what I do. If you have a question for me during this podcast and you're in the live stream, you'll see a scroll going across the bottom of the screen right now. It tells you what to do. Put the word question as the first word and all caps, so I'm more likely to see it with my one good eye. And if I do, I'll start and try to get to you at the end. If you have a comment or something, you know, talking point or something you want me to speak to, it's not really a question. Basically the same for you. They'll put the word comment in all caps. And again, if I see it with my one good eye, we'll get it done. I'll tell you, I am ready for the holiday to come. I am tired. It's been a long haul since the workshop. I've been doing something cool. It's had me really motivated, but a little bit tired. And I'll tell you about that maybe when I get back, because it's definitely something I'm going to keep doing. And hopefully many of you will be adopting it as a practice in your life. But with that said, let's get on into this. That first question here today, this is the one that I always get some version thereof when I talk to somebody who finds out what I do for a living and they're just a person that doesn't have any preparedness mindset at all. Why should I bother to prep? It's safe where I live and nothing ever happens. As I said, this is interesting to me that I hear this from people and I'm like, do you own a television set? And they're like, yeah. And you live here in North Texas. Yeah. You see how many tornadoes we get? Well, that happens. Do you remember like 3 years ago when we had like, I don't know, something like 10 million people without power for almost a week in Texas and the temperatures never got into the double digits for 5 days in a row? Do you remember that? Well, yeah, well, that did happen. Well, how'd you make out in that? Were you one of the people I saw warming your hands over the hot dog roller at the Quick Trip? Or were you like me with the generator running and the TV on and the propane heater running and you really didn't give a shit? Which one of those people were you? And generally, they weren't quite at the level of going to the Quick Trip to warm their hands over the hot dog roller. Though if you think I'm making that up, I would have never come up with that. During that exact event, I ended up going to a Quick Trip because it's one of the places it was open. And there were people in there warming their hands over the burritos and taquitos and hot dogs and sausages rolling back and forth on the rollers. They were basically hanging out there because they had no power at home. It's the real world. And so there's your answer in of itself, right? That there is no place where nothing ever happens. The real answer, though, is because we live in a very comfortable society. And that comfort is provided largely by the fact that we have amazing systems available to us today. The reality is that a person today who we consider living at the poverty line, like not maybe all the way at the bottom in a box on the street, but someone who just barely falls from, you know, kind of the middle class, lower middle class down into poverty. Most of those people live better than a king did 300 years ago. They have access to better medicine. They have electricity. They have a little box that they carry around like this here that they can access all the information in the world. In general, they do have food. They don't really have to worry about it. No one's trying to kill them to take their throne. If you ever get a chance and you're like in Europe, especially like the United Kingdom and Scotland and all that, go to some of the old castles that you can visit. There's nobility called homes, and they're impressive, but ask yourself if they turned off all the power, if you'd really want to live that way 400 years ago. And sure, the alternative was better than, you know, the other alternative being a serf 400 years ago, but it ain't necessarily that great. So we have this incredible system of comfort. Basically, you walk into a room, you want to be able to see, you flip a switch. You're too cold, you turn a little thing on your wall up and it warms the house up. You turn it down, they make it cooler if you're too hot. You're bored, you turn this screen on and people talk to you and tell you all kinds of stories from all over the world. You're hungry, you open this box and there's all this perfectly preserved food for you inside it. you want to heat it up. There's another box. You push a button a couple times and it makes a vibrating sound. And in a minute or two, you have warm, hot food, or you cook it on a stovetop if you have more time. If you're out of food, you get in your car, drive down to the store. Oh, by the way, you have a car, you have gas. You see all these things we have that are all wonderful things. I'm not saying we should get rid of them. I'm just saying when you have all those things and all of a sudden the systems of underlying support go away in one shape or another, you end up having a problem. You've become so dependent on the thing, you're like the cashier who you hand, you know, the price of an item is $5.51. You hand them a $10 bill and a penny, and they don't know what to do. That's how we all become when we become dependent on technology. Tell me, if you're in the audience listening live right now, if this experience ever happened to you, for some reason the power, water, something like that's off at your home. It's been off for a few hours. You know it's off. You haven't turned the generator on, or you're not running kind of backup water or anything. You know, maybe you even know it's a short-term thing, and you walk in the room and flip the switch or walk up to the sink, turn the, and then nothing happens. You're like, oh, yeah. It's so ingrained in us. That alone is a reason to prepare. But the simple answer is because things do go wrong, and when things go wrong, it is better to have what you need than not have what you need. And if you just think back through your life, no matter how new you are to preparedness, you will think of times where there were systemic failures. Right? Whether it was you couldn't go to the store because you were snowed in, the power was off while you were snowed in, the power is off due to a storm, and then the storm went away and a heat wave came in behind it, which is very common with tropical storms. You know, you get a hurricane come through, wipe out the damn grid, and as soon as the sky's clear, it's like 104 degrees out and it's humid as shit. It sucks. That's why we prep. And I'm not going to go further into it because this is an anointed audience. You guys are initiated audience. You guys are aware of these things. So my next one is, why should we start retelling the story of the ant and the grasshoppers to our kids again? You know, that's a big thing of mine. I don't do it as much as I used to, but when I started this show, I probably told that story about once every 3 weeks for probably the first 5 years. And part of the reason I do it is because my grandfather did it. My grandfather told me that story so many times when I'm a little kid. Little blonde ass kid, too. This hair wasn't always gray and dark, right? This hair used to be flaxen blonde. I looked like a little Dutch kid, or more accurate, a little Ukrainian kid. And I remember sitting with him on, he called it a glider. It was like an outdoor couch, but instead of rocking, it kind of slid back and forth. I don't even know what the right term for that thing is. And we'd sit out there, and he'd tell me a bunch of stories, usually right out of the, you know, kind of the fable world, you know, but his favorite one was the ant and the grasshopper. And when he told me the story, it was not the Disney version of the story. It wasn't the one where the grasshopper learned his lesson or any of that shit either. It was, and he died. That's how my grandfather used to tell it to me. And he died. He froze his ass off and then he died. And sometimes he would add to it, and the ants came out, chopped him up, took inside and ate him, because that's what grasshoppers, or that's what ants do. They eat grasshoppers. And he's like, you don't want to be a grasshopper. You want to make sure you're prepared. And that would lead into a discussion about how that beautiful garden that I was being asked to take care of for such a little kid, even though I'd be back in Jacksonville by the time fall and winter came, that my grandmother would be canning all that food. And, you know, maybe I'd be sent down to the cellar to pick up like a jar of chow chow from last season. It was still there in the summer. And this made a very big impact on me. And that's why I think we should tell it to kids, because it's a real story. It's not, obviously we're anamorphizing insects, which is not real. But the concept in a fable is always that we take something relatable and entertaining and apply it to the real world for a real world lesson. And there are really two types of people in the world when it comes to preparedness. And ant and grasshopper's a pretty decent way to describe it. There's people that make sure that they're prepared for what can go wrong. And there's people that don't, just say it'll all be okay. And they're the ones that always end up needing help. And the ones that prepare, that we call hoarders and preppers and crazy survivalists, they're the ones that always have the ability, because they have stability, to go out and help other people. And I don't know if everybody's ever explained it to you this way, but the preparedness formula is dramatically simple. And it hinges on something that, even though we use an ant and a grasshopper for, that no ant or squirrel or monkey or any animal we're aware of is truly capable of doing other than us. And that is to prepare in a methodical, logical way. Yes, the ant takes food, puts it in a hole in the ground. They got one move. It's a biological imperative. They evolved to do that. The ant does not have the ability to think even collectively as a unit and say, hey, this year might be worse than last year. We might need to work harder early on when there's abundance. It just moves at the same cycle all the time. The squirrel cannot think ahead and go, hey, this year's mast is probably going to be low because last year's mast was heavy. I'm going to have to put extra work in this year. Can't do that. All they do is bury and hide nuts. And 90% of what they bury and hide, they never see again. They don't remember where they put it. It's, again, a biological imperative. We can think ahead, so we should. So all you have to do to be prepared, and this doesn't matter if you're getting prepared for a storm or the change of seasons or a boardroom meeting. Number one, go through in your mind the scenario ahead of you and identify all the points where something could go wrong. Okay. The next step is to eliminate as many variables that can cause those problems as possible so that the problems never occur. If you were going hiking and you didn't want to sprain your ankle, part of that would just be good footwear alone will prevent 90% of sprains, at least severe sprains, where you could at least still hobble your ass out, right? So you find the variables and eliminate the variables. Some variables will be something you cannot eliminate. Like the weather, you can't eliminate it, but what you can do is mitigate its impact. So it is examine and discover, eliminate variables, mitigate the uneliminatable variables, and go on with your life. Well, that's kind of what the story of the ant and the grasshopper is. There's no way to stop winter from coming. It always comes. So yeah, we should be telling our kids that because it's a valuable life lesson and because it's kind of a cute, clever story that little kids actually will listen to. And this is something we have failed to understand as adults in this new world where when your kid is being annoying, you hand them a box and send them away and they watch TikTok videos or YouTube videos of other kids playing, right? We've lost this concept that if you want children to listen to you, you have to use language that they understand and appreciate. And I have never tried to tell a story of the ant and the grasshopper to a little kid who was old enough to understand it, who didn't listen to it. So that's why we should do it, because they'll freaking listen and they'll learn and they'll become adults with at least the ethos of preparedness in their mindset. Next up, from fires in California to recent flooding and third world disasters, what do they all have in common? Like, this is what I've been asked this more by, like, show hosts, right? People who have interviewed me say, Jack, what is the commonality? And that's interesting you say that, because I teach from the standpoint of the commonality of disaster. And the commonality is that it's always about the systems of support we let off with today. You don't prepare for wildfire. Now, you might think a little bit more about the variables and dangers and risks associated with wildfires if you live in a place where wildfires happen. And then you might do something like realize, like, the vents in the eaves of your home are the number one way that your house will burn down in a forest fire. So you do get a little bit specific with this, with your risk assessment. I'm less worried about wildfires, but I have some concerns. So I have, you know, I have vent covers in for my ember guards is what they're called, ember guards for the vents into my roof. Because you have to have breathability there. Because the number one thing is embers get inside the roof. It takes one or two little embers in there. And if they manage to catch something and it starts to go, by the time you realize it's happened to your house, once that roof is compromised, it's over. It's done. So when everybody was freaking out about California going, that house burned down and there's not even any fire. There's no trees around. How did it burn? That's embercast. Look it up. Number one reason. So there's a little bit of dialing that precision. But in the end, what it always comes down to is dealing without the things you're accustomed to have. So while there is some fine tuning, like I'm a little bit more worried about a tornado than you are if you live in Wyoming, especially in the mountainside of Wyoming. It doesn't matter why your house has the roof blown off, and it matters that. So what we always want to do is make sure that we have our survival needs in place. We have a plan for all the things that we could do without. And if we do that, it doesn't really matter what the cause is. Next up would be, because I used to talk about this a lot too, so I've been interviewed with this one a lot. What is impact scale and threat probability, and how does that impact your preparedness plan? So impact scale is how many people, how big the disaster is. So I mentioned a few of these that have happened here in Texas, and they are large impact disasters, like the Great Freeze 3 years ago. That really was a Great Freeze. There's a 63,000 acre lake about 6 miles south of me. I can't find any living people that can remember it being frozen completely over like happens to the lakes up north. It froze over. I've seen lakes like that around here with some ice on the edges during some severe. We do not have big lakes freeze over. Water's an incredible thermal battery. And even the cold that we get here when it's really, really cold, you have to have a lot of consecutive days of it to overcome that thermal mass of the water. It froze over in a couple of days. It froze over to the point people walked on it. Now, I think those people were stupid. We had nobody taking ice core samples or none of that shit like they do up for ice fishermen in the Northeast or what have you, or the Midwest. But they did it, and as far as I know, nobody fell through it. That was a big impact, right? So, but the impact scale also comes together with what's called threat probability, and I'm talking about that at the individual level. So we have some things that break this, like COVID totally broke this scenario that I put out, this disaster probability impact scale correlation. But in general, the odds that you'll be affected by any specific disaster go up the lower the number of people hit by it. Again, there's exceptions. Large regional disasters, if you happen to be in the region, or something like COVID, which was a government-caused problem, not a viral-caused problem. Now, there always is the probability that someday we will actually have an illness that actually is a bigger problem, as they said it was, and then that will be a whole new set of problems. But in general, the most mundane, boring disasters to you, as long as you're not the one with them, that's the one you're most likely to have. Trust me, when you come home and your spouse tells you they just came from the doctor and they have stage 4 cancer, it's a disaster. When you lose your job, it's a disaster. When a localized storm seriously damages your home, but it's not big enough that anybody more than a couple counties away would even know it happened, it's still a disaster for you. And these, if you think about your life, you've probably experienced plenty of individual disasters. Just because it didn't end your life or destroy your life doesn't mean it wasn't a disaster, and you plodded through it as best you can. But the more prepared you are, the less likely these things are to be disasters, or their severity in your life will be reduced. You want the honest truth? The number one way that I've heard people have used bug out bags or go bags in this audience in 17 years is my wife, my son, my daughter, my husband, something like that, ended up in the hospital. And I keep my go bag in the vehicle, so I had all the things that we needed with us at the hospital. That's, you know, no one really, like, you're not going to be on the news because that happened, unless you're part of something where 400 people ended up there. But it impacts you. So when we start looking at the commonality of disaster, along with impact scale and threat probability, it helps us develop our own individual plans. Because yes, we will look out around the horizon and say, I live in a place where it gets really cold all the time. My winter prep needs to be strong. However, when you live in a place like Dallas-Fort Worth, where I do, where we don't get a lot of winter weather, but when we do, it is ball kicking, and the place is not designed with it in mind. We don't bury our water pipes 3 freaking feet deep here. A lot of places we can't because of rock bedding and stuff like that. And they would never take and put the money into rocks on water 3 foot deep in a lot of these places with all this rock, because it's not that big a deal until it is. So we have to dial in our preparedness, but it always comes from the standpoint of meeting our primary needs, which we'll get to, well, right now, because that would lead to the question, what are your primary survival needs? Well, I say in our society, there's 6. Now, I derive my 6 by starting with wilderness survival, right? The wilderness survival component of the survival needs gives you 5 of my 6. And I change the name of one of them. So if you go take any good wilderness survival course, they're going to teach you 5 primary survival needs, and they're going to be food, water, shelter, fire, and security. Those are your five. If you have those five things in the wilderness and you're lost somewhere, you either slowly navigate your way toward a place where you're safer or found, or you stay put and make as much noise and be as obnoxious as you can until somebody finds you. Right? But that's the five needs you'll have while you're in that delta. Food, water, shelter, fire, security. Yeah? Okay, when we go to our home life, not our wilderness life, we change one of those five. And that is we change fire to energy. Because that is the purpose of fire in the wilderness. It is power. It keeps us warm. It cooks food. It boils water. We can use it to make and harden tools. It is energy. In our homes, we do all of these things and more with usually electricity. Notice I said power, though, or energy. So we need to make sure we have an energy backup as well. We have another issue that tends not to be a big issue. They don't really call it a survival need, but if you take a wilderness course, they will teach you, hey, when you have to take a crap, don't do it where you sit. Go off in the woods somewhere, dig yourself a hole, put crap in a hole and bury it, and everything will be fine. And the truth is, if you go far enough away, as long as you can find your way back to base camp, you need a crap on the ground. It might not be the most polite thing to do. We're talking about the wilderness, and billions of animals around the world take a deuce in the forest every day anyway, and the wilderness knows what to do with it, right? We have to worry about our health and sanitation differently at home than we do when we're in the wilderness. Again, in the wilderness knows what to do with our waste. We don't have a lot of stuff when we're in the wilderness, so there's not a lot of waste material. We want to hold on to most things. If it is something we really need to get rid of, throw in the fire. Yeah? Okay, so now we're home. We're in a different state. We've got mom, dad, two kids, and for one reason or another, the toilet won't flush. If we don't have preparedness, we have a problem. We're either trying to get a four-year-old to poop, okay, outside hovering over a hole, or we can give them something that looks a lot like a toilet, a bucket with a toilet seat on it. They might use that, right? So now all we need to do is something with that. So we need some sort of a composting system, or we can even just do garbage bags and the blue shit you put in toilets for RVs. But you need some concept of what to do about that. So let's go through these, and what is the short answer as to how we meet each one of these needs. Food, store it. Very simple. That's the whole thing. That's the whole answer. Eat what you store what you eat, store food, rotate it through. You should have 30 days minimum of food. The best thing you can do on all your survival needs is have 90 days of sustainability, because research from insurance companies, et cetera, has shown that if you have 90 days that you can survive and thrive in, you're going to be just fine. It's about 90 days it takes people after major life-altering events to put their life back into a reasonable level of stasis. That's everything from a job loss to the death of a loved one. I'm not saying the pain goes away. I'm saying, like, if you're a parent and you lose a child, your world is over for a while. And it takes a certain amount of time for you to cope with it, deal with it, grieve with it, and realize I have to go on. You can even look like you're doing it for a while, but it generally takes about 3 months for most things. So if we have 3 months of sustainability and viability of food and we lose the job, it's just an inconvenience as far as food goes. What does every man say when you ask him why you work so hard? I have to do two things, right? Food on the table and the roof overhead. We'll get to the roof in a minute. So food, store it. Water, store it. Same answer. I don't want to see, if I ever see one of you people in my audience crying and bitching about how much Best Buy charged for a flat of water during a freaking hurricane, I'm going to kick you right in your ass. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Best Buy is not a place you go to buy water, is it? You see those things. When I just, Best Buy happens to be the one I'm remembering. I've seen a lot of this. You see these stores, they're not grocery stores. Right? They sell bottled water for $1.80 or whatever at the register, all, and no one complains, even though you buy a whole flat of water for $3 at Walmart. And all they do when people start wanting to buy flats is they just, how many bottles, 24 times whatever, and stick that on the thing. They're not gouging you. They're charging the same price they always do. Do you know that water comes out of your sink in a manner where you can drink it? If you filter it better, but in general, you can drink the water out of your sink. If you can't drink the water out of the sink, you got a problem. You need a filtration system. So while the water is free or virtually, like mine, I consider free. I guess I do have a few pennies into electricity that runs a well pump. But even if you're on municipal water, if you do the calculations per price per gallon, it's so cheap. You know, if you buy the good toilet paper, I don't want to hear you talk about the cost of water. So it's pretty much free. So all you have to do is store it while it's available. Best storage containers I've found. The 1 gallon jugs for things like apple juice and like Arizona iced tea and 2 liter soda bottles. They're small enough to move around, right? They're incredibly strong and durable because they're designed to hold acidic and carbonated things. They're food grade. Rinse them out. If you're really worried, throw a half a teaspoon of bleach in it, shake it up, dump it out, rinse it a couple times, fill it up with water, put the lid on it, stick it on the shelf. Done. That's it. You know, water won't go bad. There has to be something in water for it to go bad. You have clean potable water into a clean container with a lid on it. It can sit there for 50 years and it'll taste like shit and a little plasticky, but it won't kill you. You'll survive. If you use it every once in a while and refill it, it won't get that stale kind of bland kind of taste, right? So rotate your water. That's it. That's it. How much water? I would say you need about 2 gallons of water per day, per person, for as long as your plan is, and that's a minimum. Because we need to be able to clean ourselves, clean our dishes, drink, and cook. And so you ain't going to be taking showers if you're down to using your bottled water. Okay? But, you know, it makes a lot of sense to keep this water on hand, even if you can bathe and stuff. My son and daughter-in-law and their two, and my grandkids just had a boil water alert. And I'm like, didn't I get you guys a Berkey? Like, yeah, we brought it over to your house when we were moving and we left it there. Maybe you should come get it back. Why don't you have any water stored? You know, it's like your own kin are the ones that don't really follow what you teach. But that should have been a non-event for them because they had water for bathing and all was fine. It was just water for drinking that they had to worry about. So they ended up running off to the store to buy water in jugs. By the way, do not store water in milk jug style jugs. I'm just going to say they are not designed for long-term storage, and sooner or later that seam fails. This is a mistake I made early on. Just make sure there's some water there. Don't have time for all this other shit. Go buy like 20 gallons of, you know, 1 gallon jugs from Walmart, stuck them in a closet at a remote property, left them there, came back 4 months later, and 3 of them had soaked into the floor. Now, that's the end of that. That's why I went to the 2 liter soda bottles and the acidic beverage jugs at 1 gallon with a handle is kind of perfect. The Arizona iced tea jug or the Mott's apple juice jug are my preferred, but the soda bottles work too. But Jack, I don't drink that. Good. I don't either, but I know people who do. And if you say, would you save these for me? Soon you'll have more than you know what to do with. And by the way, when you're at convenience stores and shit like that, sometimes you'll see stacks of the plastic things they use to make the displays for 2 liter soda bottles. A lot of times they'll give those to you. You can just ask. The worst thing they can do is say no. They're not going to beat the shit out of you because you ask. Just ask for it if you're using 2 liter soda bottles. Energy. Back it up. So food, store it, water, store it, energy, back it up. Have a backup plan. Number one recommendation I have for the most people, not all people, but most people, is a generator. And I mean a simple 6,500 to 8,500 running watt generator, pull to start, gasoline powered generator from Lowe's, Home Depot, Atwood's, Tractor Supply, take your pick. It's been the number one thing that saved our ass more times than anything else is a good generator. A good generator, and if you live a place where it gets really fucking hot, where it can actually be dangerous in the summertime during a power outage, get one or two just small, decent window unit air conditioners. Make sure you go through the process of sticking in a window, even if they get stored, put away somewhere. Pop them in one or two rooms in your house, close the fucking doors, plug them in with an extension cord, voila. You have two cool zones. If you have elderly people in your family, people with serious respiratory illnesses, infants, babies, young children, especially with additional illnesses. This is life-saving preparedness. People die every year in the heat. More than the cold is what kills people is heat. Go do that. Jesse C says Harbor Freight's 13,000 watt. That's a hell of a generator. Tri-fuel is on sale right now for under a grand. I don't know anything about the quality of that generator, but it's probably just fine. It's probably just fine. We have a Champion 7,500 running watt generator, and I have a Troy built that's 8,500 running watts that I had to do some work on. That's why I bought the Champion in the interim while I was working on it, and both of them run fine. And the Troy built, I paid 600 and something bucks for, and I bought it when we lived in Arkansas back in 2011, and it did need some maintenance, but it's still fine. So those are two low-cost, like Champion's a little bit higher quality, but two consumer-level generators. Now, I would say if you live somewhere, especially where you can have a really big, like a 500-gallon or bigger pig, propane pig, or if you have natural gas plumbing in your house, you should seriously consider getting like a Generac standby gas, natural gas generator. Because if you have that, the power goes out, it blinks and flickers and goes, and comes right back on, you run your whole friggin' house. It's expensive, but it's worth having. And if you're a dude that travels and you leave a spouse home who ain't the kind of woman that's going to roll out a Troy built and fire it up and start running extension cords, you might really want to consider that. Going off grid's even better, but not everybody can afford it. It doesn't make sense for everybody. Have a plan for that. Also have a plan for cold. There, you can do worse than a Mr. Buddy, Big Buddy heater. That's why I recommend it. I have two of them. If we have a power outage when it's cold, that's our primary heat for the home. And all kerosene heaters work good too. They're going to kill you. You don't know anything. Shut up. If kerosene heaters were going to kill us, we'd all be dead by now. Because if you didn't use it, your dad or your granddad did. And the older ones actually had a lot more risk than the new well-built kerosene heaters are fantastic. And I would tell you choose between your primary backup heat, being kerosene heater or a propane space heater based on availability of what is in your area. It is actually very difficult to find kerosene around here. Very difficult. When I lived up in Pennsylvania, almost, I would say 50% of all gas stations had a kerosene pump. So I would make the determination based on that. We have the grill adapters. We set the freaking grill tank on the outside of the window. We close the window almost all the way down with a little bitty gap to help with air exchange. The Mr. Buddy heater sits in the house. Put one back here where all the offices are and one out in the center of the home, and nothing the fuck freezes up even when it's 7 degrees out. And so that would be that. If you have a fireplace, yes, it is good. However, right? Fireplaces actually are not efficient at all. If you light up your fireplace, the big roaring fire, the room you're in will be much warmer than if you didn't do it. And when you go to like one or two adjacent rooms away, the temperature actually is lower. Because as it's heating up, most of the heat's going up the chute. It pulls air out of the space. It's like running a fan. So if you really want to rely on your fireplace for back heat, look up fireplace inserts. They're not as efficient as a stove, but they're very efficient. There's some other things that you can do. When we lived in Arkansas, I built a heat emitter, I guess is what you would call it. And all it was is I took some it was actually not even pipe. It was more like a square hollow steel. And I made what looked like a reverse radiator bowed out in the back. And then all of them were connected, and it had a little bitty fan, a little tiny 12-volt fan that would run for days on a deer feeder battery, blowing air into one side. And it went all through this, air radiator basically. And then the other end stuck out the other side and heat vented out. And we would shut the fan off during power outages in Arkansas or when we were just running the fireplace. And it did make it way, and it was scrap metal, a welder, and a $10 fan and a $12 battery to do that. So there's other ways, but if we would have stayed there instead of moving down here, I was about to buy a really good quality insert. And that will save you money year round. But one way or another, have a plan to keep yourself cool, keep yourself warm, and keep yourself taken care of. Cooking is another place people fall down with this. Coffee, you'll be surprised how much power a freaking drip coffee maker will draw from a generator, right? It's crazy how much power they draw, about 1,100 watts. So you might want to, if you're a coffee drinker, you might want to back up to that, including you know, when you know something's coming, pre-grind your coffee, have a hand grinder or something like that. But cooking, I'm going to cook on the grill. You ever boil water on a grill if you ain't got a side burner? Not fun. So a good camp stove is great, but the number one tool, if you want a great, use it all the time to cook tool for backup cooking as well, is a flat top griddle, like something like a Blackstone. You can boil on them. You can put a freaking tea kettle right over the burner, that where the burner runs vertically underneath the top, boil water. I did a couple of weeks ago. I had Chef Ken and my buddy David and his wife Mona here, my wife. We did a freaking full-on freaking like clam bake, basically. We did little neck clams, mussels, scallops, and shrimp. And the scallops and shrimp, we gave a little color on the flat top first. But I used a full-size sheet aluminum throwaway pan, threw a whole bottle of white wine in there, a stick of butter, a big old all the garlic, some seasoning, and threw everything in there and sealed, and then sections of Dungeness crab on top, and foil wrapped it on a Blackstone. If you can do that, you can do just about anything. So if you're looking for an outdoor cooking solution that you want to be a perfect backup, it's hard to beat a Blackstone. You can fry. You can bake if you know how to do it on a Blackstone. So check that out as well as another option. Moving on, security. Security we handle with a combination of gear, procedure, and protocol. Okay, gear is things like if there's a danger of a home invasion, you have a weapon. That's gear. Gear is alarms are gears. Security camera is gear. Anything, any item that you have or system in place that runs on like power or, you know, energy or any of that is probably gear. Fencing is gear, right? Signage, whether it's no trespassing in peacetime or you loot, we shoot in wartime, is gear. All of that is gear. Procedures are how you do a thing. When I carry a gun, how I pick it up, how I make sure that it's condition ready, how I holster it, how I carry it, that's a procedure. When I come home, what do I do with my gun? Well, in my case, I don't do anything. I don't have to worry about a kid picking a gun up because it's strapped to my ass. But at some point, I'm going to take a, like, where do you put your gun when you're taking a shower? That's a procedure. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just saying that's a procedure. Where is it when you sleep? That's a procedure. These are all procedures. How you drive to and from work and how that might change, a different procedure, right, if there's riots. But procedures are the individual thing, like the tactic and the method of the tactic. What is a protocol? A protocol is an assembly of procedures. And protocols shift based on the reality on the ground. In other words, I might drive to work the same damn way every day, but if there's problems, I have a different protocol, right? I might carry my gun, you know, X hours a day, but if there's problems, maybe I carry it 24 hours a day. I might tell the kids when they want to go outside and play, just go outside and play. But if storms are coming or riots are happening in my neighborhood or something like that, the protocol shifts. And that's just the best number one way to think about your security needs. Gear, procedures, and protocols. And the assemblage of those and how they're altered across time based on the threat at the time. I don't want to belabor it because I can do a whole show just on security. How about health and sanitation? Well, keep supplies, have a plan to eliminate waste, and get basic training. So health and sanitation, is we talked about it already from a standpoint of human waste, and that's necessary. We also need to think about how you're gonna bathe yourself if you have no water. Long term, we're going to have to come to some sort of a shower-based solution. If we're worried about that a lot, maybe we have a large water tank with some sort of DC-powered solar pump, some kind of solar heat and everything. But short term, everybody can do it. Disaster preparedness is know how to take basically a soldier's bath. There's another name for it. I'm going to leave that out today. I'm going to try to be somewhat family friendly today. If you need to think that in your head, go ahead, you dirty minded person, right? But basically, you're going to take and use a washcloth and you're going to rinse off your face and your arms and your pits and your privates, back of your knees, right? And you're going to use, you know, basically a bowl with and soap and a bowl with just water and a washcloth and a towel. It's not the nicest. Think of it as a hospital bath, to be another family-friendly way to put it, right? Clean yourself up. And you need to know how to do that and have the stuff you need to be able to do that. You also need to think about things like medical conditions. And there's a lot of overlap here. I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to put that on the screen. Yeah, I like that. But, you know, you need it. Like, if you have somebody with let's say, diabetes that's insulin dependent, you should have 60 days minimum of insulin on hand, whether it's oral or injectable. Any sort of medication that is literally required for your health and well-being, minimum 60 days. If your doctor will not work with you to kind of get you to that and then, you know, fill monthly prescriptions of it, right, you need a new doctor. You need a new doctor. That's bullshit. I mean, we're not talking about your medicine, right? That's really so you can get high. We're talking about things that your doctor would say, no, this would be really bad for you to miss a couple days a row in this. It could be life altering. It could be health altering. It could kill you. If that's the case, then you can't be sitting there 5 days from a prescription refill before you can refill it. And you ain't got no extra battery or buffer. You got to have that in place. And you need to know how to handle emergencies when no one's coming. So having basic first aid training and procedures and protocols in place for those things as well is a good idea, because you can't always dial 911 and expect somebody to show up. And there was a big winter storm going back about 8 or 9 years, and it was somewhere near Chicago. And this family called 911, and for whatever reason, the responders got as close as they could. They said, you got to come to us. And this guy was a huge fat guy, and instead of figuring out to, like, I don't know, throw the table upside down on the ground, lay his fat ass on it and drag him, they kept arguing and saying, you have to come to us. And they said, well, we can't. And the guy died while they argued on the phone. You need to make sure shit like that doesn't happen. That's part of health and sanitation. When I talk about health and sanitation, I am talking about waste, but I'm talking about overall physical, mental, emotional health as well. All right, how important is it to own guns and store ammo, boy? I get that from everybody, from you guys to the people at the dinner party to the host of another show that interviews me. How do we need to have a gun? What kind of gun should I buy? I would say this is an individual choice, but this is my personal answer. You should have a self-defense sidearm that you are well-trained with and you carry. You should have enough ammo on you for at least one reload. You should have enough ammo in storage as backup. I'm going to say that with a handgun, a couple boxes, the old box, like 50 round boxes, before the price went up, they start putting everything in 20 round boxes. Right? That's a minimum. I know you know that I have more than that for everything. But not everybody needs an AR. Not everybody needs a main battle rifle, right? But I personally think if you are a responsible fucking adult and you are aware of what goes on in the world and you can have a carry firearm in your state, in your jurisdiction, you should have one. And if you can't, and there's very few places you really can't anymore in America, then you should have one in your home and you should have the training on how to use it. That's how much you need. Then it's how much do you want based on just your pure wants and your risk tolerance. Personally, me, kind of a minimum for me is I want a handgun. I want a 22 handgun for practicing because I want to practice more than I can afford to with my center fire. Okay. I don't need this, but I like owning at least one really good hunting handgun because I like to handgun hunt. I want a hunting rifle, something center fire, 30-06, 308, 270, 7mm, 6.5 Creed. You pick, I don't care. Right? I want that. I want a good all-purpose shotgun. And I want a 22 rifle. If I have that, my personal needs are met. My personal wants are not. I'm not going to pretend to be that guy. I have my six gun arsenal. I'm good. I have ARs. I have an AK. I have some other things I don't even want to talk about. You can have whatever you want. But if you have something and you don't have ammo for it, it's pointless. It's an expensive club or a barter item. So there should be, you know, a few boxes of ammo for every cartridge that you know, have a weapon for. I don't want to say caliber because the gun police will get all upset. It's not caliber. There's plenty of rounds that are the same. Yeah, everybody knows what I'm saying, and you do too. You just want to be that person, so I headed you off in the past. Next one, what is the best way to be prepared for power outages? We kind of covered that with the needs, right? A generator. A generator is your number one preparation for power outages. And I would say a close second is going to be some sort of alternative heat, like the propane heaters that we talked about, and some way to cook, which, again, I'm back to a flat top griddle being one of the best tools you can have, a good Camp Chef stove system, like a two burner stove. Those are great too. Well, that's your number one preparedness. And also to just kind of think through it. Like, to understand that if you have a generator, can't run everything at all times in your home, that's okay. You keep those two rooms cool with the window units. And if you're doing that and lights and everything, everything's good. But let's say you have a couple of refrigerators. If you plug everything, the generator's overtaxed. Well, unplug the air conditioners for about an hour. Run your refrigerator freezers for about an hour. Throw a bunch of moving blankets over your refrigerator freezer. Don't open them unless you need to. And you can run them three or four times a day and everything will be fine. I mean, for three or four times a day for an hour each, everything will be fine. So think, again, the mitigation and elimination of variable strategy is huge here because you can only do so much with gear. You're the operator. I'll put it this way. I give one person a set of hand tools and basic power tools, and they can build me a house. I give it to somebody else, and they can kind of sort of put together a table for me. And I give it to somebody else, and they nail themselves to the fucking wall with it, right? The operator's the variable, not the gear. But even the best operator needs decent gear or they cannot operate, right? So that's the way to come at this from, you know, the power out of standpoint. But a generator for most people is going to be your number one thing, backup heat and something to cook with. And since we covered that so much under energy, I'm going to go short on that so we can get through this together today. Next, how much food does a family really need to store? Need. That's another word, right? It means different things to different people. I say minimum, as a grown-ass man or woman with a family, if you couldn't shut your front door and not leave for a month and no one was going to starve, you are dramatically irresponsible. Dramatically irresponsible. I didn't say they wouldn't get bored eating the same shit, right? I didn't say they wouldn't feel like they're missing something. I'm just saying that no one would be like, oh my God, I'm so hungry, and they lost 10 pounds. And not 10 pounds they needed to lose, like 10 pounds that they really didn't need to lose. Like, if somebody's going to do that in 30 days in your home, you're dramatically irresponsible. Dramatically. And so that is my butt cold minimum. And if we could get every household in America to think that way, 90% of our problems would go away. However, the number I actually recommend is 90 days for the same reason I gave you earlier, that in general, it's about when we have a catastrophic life-altering event, but it doesn't kill us. Right. And we're not the one in the wheelchair for the rest of our lives, et cetera. It's just, it derailed our life, a job loss, something that mundane. If you can go 90 days and be relatively comfortable without raiding the retirement account, your life will go right the fuck back on track. So if that's the case, then that is the number we should shoot through with every prep. That's a quarter of a year. To put that in perspective, it's almost December. If you had 90 days of food right now, you're good till fucking March. Think about that. Like, you should, between now and March, be able to figure your shit out. Right? You notice we're not talking about the zombies marching in the apocalypse. It's raining cats and dogs, and they're having puppy kittens turning into zombie cat dogs and killing everybody here. Or nuclear Armageddon or any of that stuff today. Is any of that stuff possible? Sure. Is it probable? No. And you're probably going to die anyway. This doomsday prepper porn bullshit is not the place to, and we're talking basics today anyway. So if you're going to get there and you ain't where I'm talking about today, you're so far from there, you need to not worry about it. You're the person telling me, I want to start a business. I want to start a business. I go, great. You ever run a business before? No. Well, I want to make $1 million a year. You've never made a dollar in a business before. No. We need to figure out how to make your first dollar. Oh, I don't want to talk about that. You have to make your first dollar to make your second. You have to make your first 10,000 to make your next, to make 20. You got to make 20 before you make 40. You got to make 40 before you make 80. So all of these basics you have, I don't care how far you want to go, till you have the basics done, you don't need to worry about the advanced shit. I had that guy here I talked about this summer, cutting a bunch of trees on my land. He's like, sometimes, my wife made the mistake of telling, there's people I do not want them to know what I do, because it always starts, and it's usually the redneck with something like a tree cutting business or something that fancies himself a survivalist, right? And, you know, so he's like, sometimes I just kind of want it to happen, because if it did, I feel everything would be better when it's over. And I'm like, I notice you're out there cutting these trees in my property, and you don't have a pair of Kevlar chaps. If you put that saw into your thigh and you're in the hospital for 30 days, how close are you to bankruptcy? He said, I'm either there or a week away. But how the fuck do you think you're prepared for the apocalypse? And you could see the little squirrel running in the wheel in his head. And to be fair to this kid, he's like in his 20s. Yeah. Didn't argue. Because, oh, you're making, and I talked about a couple other scenarios. So this basic preparedness is something a lot of people think that they're ready for the end of the world. We're going to fight them. We're going to fight the blue helmets or whatever. They're not ready to fucking lose their job. This is fantasy shit. If you can get that prepared, God bless you. But if you ain't here yet, I don't want to hear it. So, 90 days on the food storage. Here, what is the most important yet least expensive item most families don't have but should? That came to me from Tom Woods. I think he thought he was going to throw me a hard-to-hit pitch here. I'm like, bro, I've been talking about this from the beginning. It's a documentation package. It's essentially free. You can probably find a three-ring binder, steal paper from the office, and even use the office printer, right? So somebody, there's no such thing as free, but somebody else paid for it. It's free to you. Even all in, I mean, you're talking 10 bucks to put one of these together. If you've never listened to it, just go to the site and type in the search box at thesurvivalpodcast.com documentation package, and it'll give you everything you need to know to do it for yourself. But here's some of the things in it. All the contact information for everybody you need to contact during a disaster. That is not just like your doctor and your best friend and your family. That's things like if you had to evacuate and you have three, and there also should be evacuation routes and three different ways you leave the area. Once you get, let's say, 50 to 100 miles out, three hotels along each route, their numbers. Jack, you fool, when there's something like that going on, you can't get in a hotel because everybody already got them. Really? That's funny. How'd those motherfuckers get those hotel rooms? They called first. They were prepared and you weren't. The fact that most people weren't being prepared is why this works. You're going to bug out to a hotel room? If I'm bugging out for less than a fucking week, and I got my two kids with me, and one of them's 4 years old, and I got my dog... Yeah, I probably, and I don't have a bug out location because most people don't. Yeah, my freaking Visa card and a phone call is my number one preparedness item for that specific situation, which happens to people all the time. I'll figure out how to pay that hotel bill. I got an emergency fund. I'm good. It's a camping trip in a Holiday Inn. It's not the only thing, but it would be one of the things. How about my buddy with the tree service? You should have about three or four tree service contractors that can come do things like get the oak tree out of your yard that's blocking your car in so you can get your car out. Well, I got a chainsaw. I'll do it myself. What if the tree fell through your roof and broke your fucking arm? Is your wife going to do it? Do you want her doing it? What if you're not that guy and you can't do it? What if you're a single mother and you can't do it? You see what I'm saying? Yes, it's based on your particular risk tolerance, but all the type of contractors you might need in a disaster. Do you know what they do? This is what you do. You do business with them in peacetime, and they value you in time of war. Okay. But it's also a first come, first serve. So when you already know who you're calling for the problem and it's in there, you make that phone call. It might even include people that can do things like if you had to leave, but now they're a lot closer to your home than you are, they can do a drive-by for you, take a picture and say, yeah, your home's good. Here's a picture of it. That would be some of the things that would go in there. There's a bunch of other shit that goes in there. All the places you need to contact, like your banks, insurance companies and shit goes in there. And if there's any kind of account number, develop your own system of encryption. I give you one in the show on documentation if you need to do it. Again, though, the maps, the routes, and what you want are rally points on the routes, because maybe you're here, your teenage daughter's there, and your wife's here with kid, your other younger kid. And there's an evacuation order, or something's going down, and everybody's all freaking out on the cell phone. I don't know what to do. Turn to page 9. All of them need to, there needs to be one in every vehicle and one in the house. And when they get updated, they all get updated. That's why we use a 3-ring binder. We take those pages out or add them in. So you go to, honey, you got your daughter on the phone. She's 17-year-old. She's at school. She's freaking out. She can't come home. Go to evacuation route 1 and meet daddy at rally point B. I don't know where they go to page 9. See that? Do that. Calm comes. Calm comes. Go listen to that episode. I don't want to belabor it. I went through every single thing in it. There was a master gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps close to retirement by the time I released that. It was in the middle 100s, that long ago. I went to an event that I spoke at. He walked up to me and he said, that, sir, is the most detailed, specific, organized plan I have ever heard for the average person. This guy had like 20-odd years in the Corps at that point. So it was a pretty high endorsement. Moving on, what role does gardening and homesteading play in your preparedness, or is it just a hobby? As much as you make it, as much as you integrate it, as much as you make it part of your life. To me, it's a huge thing because, number one, you know that 90-day food supply? If I'm doing things like canning and dehydrating, if I'm gardening 3 or even 4 seasons, I extended my storage by what I can produce. So that's part of it. Health and sanitation, if you're eating food that you're growing for yourself, whether it is the garden or the eggs from your chickens or the meat from the sheep you're raising, you're going to be healthier. Living off food you produce will inevitably make you a healthier person than living off food you buy at a grocery store. I'm just being dead serious with that. Or as young people say, dead ass, right? You know? Really, I mean, you're just going to be healthier. You're going to take less trips to the grocery store. You're going to buy less Doritos. You want to be healthy, eat less Doritos. And Doritos are a metaphor for everything like them. When you look at the label and it says high fructose corn syrup, okay, or other words you cannot pronounce, red number 5, yellow number 4, etc. Don't eat that shit. Soybean oil is not human food. Cottonseed oil is not fucking human food. Here's an interesting thing. You know all the shit? The crazy health nuts like me tell you not to eat. Don't eat food dyes. Don't eat seed oils. Don't eat high fructose corn syrup. Produce any of it on your property. Go ahead. I dare you. If you can't produce it, you probably shouldn't be eating it as a staple anyway. Just saying. So I think it's incredibly important and helpful to your preparedness to garden, to homestead, to raise livestock, etc. Practice permaculture, plant perennials, whatever it is that works for you. But it also is going to improve your preparedness because there's a certain amount of physical activity. There's a routine. It's good for your mental health. It's good all around. Why is debt elimination critical to preparedness lifestyle? I think the first time that I got a version of that, I was on the Mic in the Morning show, AM radio TV show, was AM or FM, I don't remember, but it was a pretty big talk, national syndicated talk show. And this is kind of in the build up to 2012 when all the hype was starting, things, shows like Doomsday Preppers were coming out, and like this was like a big thing the media built up. So they reached out to me to come on the show, and the host asked me, said something to the effect of, sometimes when I listen to what you're saying, you almost sound like Susie Orman or something. I'm like, oh, please don't say that. I hate that mousy bitch. But is this really a preparedness topic? Of course it is. And I remember asking, I said, what would you do if you got a phone call and said, hey, sorry about this, but your show is canceled? How dramatically would that affect your life? And how much at that point would be better off if you weren't deeply in debt, especially in depreciating assets? He said, do you know something I don't know? That was the response. Like, no, man, I'm not saying. I'm just saying, like, when we have debt on things that have no lasting value, we need to start thinking about this differently. It's not what it costs you in dollars. What does it cost you in time? What does it cost you in time? Let's say that you go out and you buy some consumer level piece of shit, a TV set, $500. You buy a pretty nice TV set for $500 today. But you buy it on a store credit card with 18% interest rate. Well, that's dumb. Don't do that. But that's what you did. So there's the base price of $500. You know, so if you make $25 an hour, that's 20 hours of your life that you exchange for that television. You're already probably thinking about buying that television a little bit differently the minute you do that. But how many years will it take you making that sweet little minimum payment of $25 that they say you can make on your Sears credit card? I guess they're not in business anymore, whatever credit card. Hell, Visa and MasterCard are freaking 18, 22% now. If you do that, well, you might pay 10 years to pay that to zero if you don't put anything else on it. You take the total cost of that, but also take the total time you live with that over your head and look at the cost in how much of your life you then gave for something that you might still owe money on by the time it's outdated and defunct and you don't want it anymore. It just blew up and it ain't worth fixing. See, I'm fine with debt on something like a house. If you maintain a home and you don't buy it in a complete third world shithole neighborhood, that house appreciates in value while you pay for it. And I also look at it this way, like even with current interest rates at like 6%, you should be able to do better than 6% in your investing. If you can't do better than 6%, you need a new investment manager or financial advisor, or you need to make better decisions if you're doing it for yourself. I'm old and I bought my house a while ago. I have about a 3% mortgage. You guys probably figure out who my investment manager is. It shouldn't be hard to figure out, but I'll tell you what, as much as I like him, if he wasn't making me more than 3%, his ass would be fired. Right? I run kind of my own investments on one side and certain investments on that side, let that be run by somebody else. But if I were to take the money that I have in those investments out and pay the house to zero, I lose long term. So I don't hate debt in of itself. I hate the wrong kind of debt. If you can't leverage the asset that you're buying with debt a second time, it's bad debt. Unless it is specific to keep ongoing run costs down for the business that is your life. So that for most people, the other exception would be a car if you buy the right car. I buy everything inside my business. It's a totally different tax calculation when you do that. I'm in a much better position. But even if you just have a regular job and you have to get to your work every day, I understand that a vehicle is basically a business asset for your life. The government may not give you the tax advantage it gives me, but it's what it is. And I understand that most people can't just walk out and open the checkbook and write a check for the price of a car. When you start buying depreciating assets that don't enable you to earn money on credit, you're setting yourself up for pain. And if you go look at the bonuses paid to the C-level officers of these giant corporations to do all this lending, Visa and MasterCard, and then all the subsidiaries that use them as the back end, Capital One and all that shit, right? Go look at how much money these fuckers are given in bonuses and then ask yourself where that money comes from. It doesn't come from a fucking leprechaun at the end of a rainbow riding a fucking unicorn finding pots of gold. It comes out of your pocket. As soon as you understand, it's you might as well be a fucking casino. When you go to Vegas and you look at those big, beautiful casinos, it's not winners that built that casino. It's losers that gave their money to the house to build a new house. That's that kind of debt. Last one. What is career resiliency? And why should it never be overlooked? Well, I've alluded to this a few times, but for the majority of people, the number one disaster you're likely to experience is losing your job. If there's someone here that never lost a job in your life, say never, and in the live chat for me, and if you have lost a job, put I have. Any job. I don't care if you were 17 and they fired you because you farted while you were working in the face of your boss. If you ever lost a job, put either never or I have. And we'll just see how that comes up while I talk about this. Most people have lost a job in their life. And when you lose a job when you're 17 because you farted on your boss's face or something, it's annoying, but it doesn't change your life. But when you have a good job and you're making six figures and you lose it, that can hurt. The more debt you have, the more it can hurt. It's a problem. And in general, even if we're well prepared, we need another job or we wouldn't have had the one we lost, because most people don't have jobs because they just want a job. They have a job to sustain their lifestyle. And the problem that many, there's one, yes, I have, right? Right. But the problem many people have is they don't put any thought into their career resiliency. And the happier they are where they work, or the more resigned they are to, I'm going to finish my career here, the more that becomes the case. And what is a lack of career resiliency looks like? You show up every day to your job exactly the way you're supposed to. That's part of a bad career resiliency. That's not a bad thing to do, but if that's where it ends, there is no career resiliency. Let's say that your boss loves you. I mean, loves you like a child. And his boss loves him like a child. Everybody loves everybody, and you're the best employee there. And I'm not saying in your head, you really are. You're going to be the last person let go. Oh, and your boss and your boss's boss. They'll still let you go before they let themselves go. And if your company goes bankrupt, and it can happen because it does, and it's happened to some of the biggest corporations in the world almost overnight, WorldCom, Enron, just to name a couple, then it can happen to your company, Bill's Tire and Wheel, or whoever you work for. So what is career resiliency? Career resiliency is you always live like you have one foot out the door, even though you don't. If your industry has certifications, even if your employer doesn't value them that much, you should be obtaining them over time. You should always be in touch with what's going on in your industry, who's hiring and who's not. Your resume should always be updated. The people that you think are references, if you don't call those people a couple times a year, you're fucking stupid. You know, I mean, if I get a call as a reference for somebody, I haven't even spoken to them in 5 years. This is how that call is going to go. Oh, Tom. Yeah, Tom's good dude. I'm just going to be honest. I haven't heard from him in 5 years. But let me tell you about Tom 5 years ago. He always showed up on time. He did his job. He was attentive to detail, etc. But you're asking me to put my name next to yours, and I ain't heard from you in 5 years. If I care about my own reputation, I'm going to hedge that. If you're in a competitive bid during a downturn to get a job and you've got your references hedging that way and the other side doesn't, they're getting the fucking job. So you stay in touch with your references. Your resume stays up to date. I don't have quite a few I haves, but I don't have any nevers yet. It's interesting. You know, something that happened to people, they don't think it's going to happen to them again. That's kind of foolish, isn't it? Right. So anyway, you know, you stay in touch with those references. You have that resume updated, and you should always be looking for another job. Now, you don't want to do it such that it comes back to your employer and they think you're disloyal and they're going to kick you to the curb. I don't mean that. You just need to always have some feelers out if you're an employed person. And that way, you know, certain things like, hey, there's not a lot out there for me if I lose this. That's like you don't want to go to the doctor because he might tell you you're sick. Well, you're sick anyway. You need to know, and then you can do something about it. Because then you can start saying, well, shit, if there isn't a place that I can easily go with what I have, what do I need to have to be able to go somewhere else adjacent to this industry, somewhere similar? What do I need to buck up on? Where can I earn as much money or more than I do now? By doing this process, you may simply find there's a better opportunity across the street and you might want to take it, or you might want to then negotiate with your current employer because you might be a little more valuable than you think you are. And you're going to find something out about getting paid once you're hired. You're going to mostly only get what you ask for. Like, your employer might do an annual 3% raise or something like that, but you're not going to get anything more than is generally just handed out if you don't ask for it. You're going to have to go after promotions. You're going to have to sit down and say, hey, Bill, look, I know that you guys do a 3% raise, but here you should be keeping track of your own metrics and accomplishments at work. Here's all the things that I've done. Here's how I'm gauging my own progress, and here's how I'm gauging my own improvement. You need to be your own manager. That's part of career resiliency. If you can't quantify certain things about your job that you do to the point where they can be measured and recorded and compared week to week, month to month, and quarter to quarter, what are you even doing? I mean, I don't know if you work a Walmart register. I could still do it, but I know it won't matter. You need to be looking for something better. But if you're doing something that's earning you a good living, trust me, your employer has a way they're quantifying your performance. Your job should be to develop a better way of quantifying your performance. Number one reason, hopefully your desire is to move up in your career. When you move up in your career, you usually end up with people that did your job in the, you know, that are doing the job you were doing, working for you. That's how career progression works. Well, when you go in and it's between you and three other people to get that promotion, and you've quantified your work with metrics that can be measured and demonstrated that you've gotten better, by the way, that's only half the equation. You're now interviewing for the job you already have instead of the one you're trying to get. Yeah? But when you can turn that around and say, but this would be the one of the things I'd like to put in place to gauge the performance of the entire team. And this is how we'll know who your best performers are. And your company doesn't already have that. You just got the fucking job. Not only did you get a job, you got a raise over what they were going to pay you when they gave you the promotion, assuming they have the money. Or if you have to go somewhere else, now you can embellish your resume without lying about it outright. Developed metrics for tracking the performance of team members. Just happened to be one, maybe. And you can say, I'm showing you what I did for myself as part of this program because I don't want to reveal anything about anybody else. You're not lying. You don't want to reveal anything about anybody else, do you? It's just thinking this way that's important. That's career resiliency. It's probably the number one most overlooked thing in the lives of most people that would be most easily done because, like the documentation package, other than things like certification and training, it's mostly free. Because career resiliency is also working on yourself every day. Whether that's through affirmations, getting up early and getting certain things done before you even go to work, physically taking care of yourself, all of it. That's part of your career resiliency. I know people that if they just improve their physical appearance, they would advance in their careers. Some of them, they just don't really keep themselves looking very nice. And I realize I do have a homeless man Santa beard right now, but there's a reason for that. And I work for me, right? But some of them, they just need to maybe just do a little bit of upkeep onto like their clothing and their hygiene and everything. And there's other people, like, I hate to be the guy to say it, but there's certain jobs, if you're super obese, you're not getting them. They might not even be physically enduring jobs, but if you have to deal with people on a regular basis, you're going to have to lose weight if you want that job. That's part of career resiliency. It's not fair. I don't give a fuck if it's fair or not. It is. It's reality. Anybody tells you that your appearance doesn't matter to your career is lying to you. You don't have to be a GQ model if you're a dude or like a super hottie if you're a gal, but you need to look as good as you can for the role that you have. And you need to be in physical condition as well. That's part of career resiliency. So there it is. There's 12 items of basic preparedness that you won't hear about from most people in this industry because they don't think this way. They're all about selling you based on fear. You know, you can pump and dump precious metals to people. They're a great investment, but if that's all you're going to do is scare people into buying silver, eventually, I got enough silver, I'm going to go find somebody else to listen to. You can scare people into buying MREs and Mountain House with the end of the world as we know it as a potential. But there's a point where people go, wait a minute, I was all afraid the world was going to end. I have a garage full of pallets of food, and the world is still going, and it's been 5 years. But when you teach preparedness as a lifestyle, you build longevity and you build people who are more resilient, more anti-fragile people. I'm going to just say Thomas, who just put up question, Bitcoin question mark. I have that starred. That makes only three questions I have to answer. I don't understand that question. So while I answer the other two, you should tell me what you want to know about Bitcoin, because Bitcoin question mark is not a question. It's a statement with a question mark next to it that could mean anything of a, do you mean what happened to it and why it went down in price? Do you mean, should you buy it? Did you mean how, like, tell me what you mean, and I'll start answering other questions here at the end. Top Cone, how you doing, Top? Prep with the PACE method, primary, alternate, contingency, emergency. I like it. I think it's very similar to what I'm saying. Primary, alternate, contingency, emergency. I like that. Yeah. I think for most people, though, that's very military-minded, which makes it good. But I think for most people, assess and imagine, right? I don't necessarily have a word diagram for this, like an acronym. But look out ahead of you. What could happen? What could go wrong? And what are the variables? Which variables can we eliminate? Again, variables that cannot be eliminated, how do we mitigate them? And then accept that you've done what you can. And again, the reason I like that mindset is if I'm preparing for a presentation to a board of directors or a storm, it works equally well. Let's do the boardroom scenario to see how well that mindset works. So number one, I'm going to go do a presentation to a bunch of stodgy guys, right? So I know that one of the variables is if I'm doing anything that has to work in real time, like a software demo or something like that, or pulling up like a website that we created with the team and showing it work in real time, it might be a little bit impressive, but shit can go wrong. And sometimes nothing's wrong with the thing on the other end. It's just the way it displays. I don't do that. Don't care where I'm doing a presentation. I take screen captures because the picture will show up. I have eliminated the variable of a software malfunction, an audio video malfunction, or anything like that when I'm doing that presentation. That is elimination of a variable. So eliminate the variables. Mitigation of the variable. You don't know what question they're going to ask you. You don't know what of your statistics they're going to challenge. You don't know what's going on in your industry potentially that they might turn back on to why your presentation's bad. I had used to have a different way of dealing with this, but now that we have large language models like ChatGPT, we take all the data for the presentation, we stick it in there, and we say, your role is you are a highly critical board of directors evaluating my performance and this presentation. I want you to ask me the 20 most hostile gotcha questions you can and gauge my responses. And then after that, you say, now I want you to act as a friendly board of directors who just wants to vet and verify what I said and do the same thing. Ask me 20 more questions. You've mitigated the variables. You cannot control how those people are going to react. You did your best with your presentation, but you don't know what they're going to say, do, or respond like. Now you're more prepared than you can imagine. Right? And then accept, okay, this is happening. I've been called in front of all these guys that can fire me or ruin my career with a look. I've done everything that I can. I'll do my best. That's why I like. That's why I've come up with that methodology. Next up, Tori the Wandering Ringama, I guess, is how they'd say all that. Wandering Ma, Tori the Wandering Ma. It's all one word, no hyphens. So it took me a second. Question on food storage, how to eradicate mice. I store food in the basement and the food was decimated. I've yet to eradicate the mice. I hate saying this, but poison eradicates mice. I think I've actually covered them before. I don't know if they're on T-SPAS or not, but when you go to like, this works on rats too. When you go to like grocery stores or malls or movie theaters, a lot of times you'll see these little black boxes sitting around outside. They're for rodents. And basically the toxin in them is heparin or does the same thing heparin does. In other words, it's a blood thinner in a high dose relative to the weight of the animal and the amount of food that they'll consume. And effectively what it does is cause them to bleed out internally. And the reason this is a good thing is a mouse can only eat so much, a rat can only eat so much. So even if one of those critters does die and something like your dog eats it, it's not going to get sick and die. Because there's really no, if you take a lethal dose of this shit, treating symptoms, there's not much a vet or a hospital for a human can do here. It's a very serious life-threatening thing. But it also is dose dependent. The same thing that is a dose for a person who needs blood thinners because of a medical condition is a death sentence to a mouse. And the box keeps things from getting. If you do have pets that can get into things, you need to put it where they can't get it. They lock with two keys. Old Cobbler was the brand that I used when I've used this stuff. They go on a little metal rod inside through a hole, like a corn cob with a hole in it. And that way they can't take it out and they have to go through this kind of maze to get in there and eat it. And it kills the shit out of them. And because of the way that it works, it pretty much turns them into a dehydrated flat pancake when they die. So if they die somewhere and you don't find them, they don't end up stinking. And that's probably the easiest thing you can do. And it works on mice and rats. And again, for your dog or something to get sick because of it, they'd have to eat a fuck ton of them. And honestly, the way they end up dead, they don't really appeal to the animals. And I had a pretty bad rat problem in between cats here on the farm with all the duck feed and stuff like that. And it completely wiped them out. Instead of decimating your food, decimate the mice. That's your number one. Or get a cat. Get a cat in a litter box and have them spend a lot of time down there and you won't have many mouse problems. We have a cat named Fox right now, and he's been knocking them out hard. So the Bitcoin question, so this is not a preparedness question. On the Bitcoin, I figured this is what is being asked. Well, actually, no, it's a different person asking the question. Price drop, the same thing. So it's two people basically want, is this the bottom? I don't know. Calm down. Here's what I'm going to tell you. If you're not comfortable owning an asset, any asset, Bitcoin or not, for 5 years, don't own it for 5 minutes. I mean, really. I'm going to tell you what I think is going on. Mark Moss put out a great, if you know Mark Moss, just look up his YouTube channel. I shared this on X today as well. He put out a great video saying basically we have an unwinding short selling situation going on here. And in those situations, people are not selling because they want to. They're selling because they have to. And somebody's been selling a massive amount of Bitcoin at about 8:30 a.m. every morning, like clockwork, at the exact same time. That's not retail fear. And there's a lot of people that piled into this market that ain't been through this before. And everybody and their mother's crying. And everybody has a conspiracy theory. And it's really because BlackRock did something. Or Trump's trying to steal your Bitcoin. On the other. Shut up. Is this the bottom? I don't know. Historically speaking, we're heading into a down year. And then three up years. And will that happen this time? I don't know. I actually think that the fundamentals of the market are stronger than they've probably ever been going into this part of a cycle. And I think if anything, we have a very muted downturn, and we may not. You may have a rip roaring 2025. This may be the year that we break out from it, and it may not be. This is all I know. If you're holding Bitcoin now and you hold it for 5 years, you'll be glad you did. And if you don't, you'll wish you did. That's all I can tell you about that. That's all I can tell you about that. There is no concern in my life about the price of Bitcoin going down. I'm going to also put it a different way. I don't even know what the hell the price is right now. Let me check. So you don't think I'm uninformed. I've been on the air with you guys for an hour and a half. I don't check the price all the time, but I think the price is somewhere around 87,000, 88,000 or something like that right now. Let me see. 86,300. Okay. Not that long ago, Bitcoin was at $80,000 and it was at an all-time high at $80,000. If I go back, that would be about, we're going to say April. In April, Bitcoin was in the $80,000 range and I was happy. Why wouldn't I be happy now? Now, if you aped in at an all-time high, which I've always told you not to do, you may not be happy. If I go back to 2024 in March, it was at 65 grand, and that was an all-time high, and everybody was happy. if you look at the performance of the asset over time, it moves in one direction. So when people start getting into this nebulous shit, now there are macros of the cycle, and you give me a couple months and I'll probably be like, okay, we're going to the absolute bottom of whatever this cycle is, or it ain't happening. But it takes time. I do not react emotionally to this. I just actually found out that River has a feature, and I hit up Jack Maulers and the strike team, who actually do respond to me at times, and said, y'all need to add this. It's called Double Down. And basically, like, I have a daily buy on Strike. I buy a minimum of about $300 a month in Bitcoin, a minimum. And I do that with a $10 daily buy. Well, River has a feature. You can say if between my last buy and now, the price drops by, let's say, more than 3%, it automatically doubles your buy. I don't know exactly how flexible it is, but I saw them talking about it on X. I'm like, y'all need this, right? Like, when there's a dip, it automatically doubles your buy based on the deposit you have of cash on hand to make buys. That's my mindset. Go down, baby. I'd love to stack another whole coin, right? I ain't gonna say how many I have, but I'd love to stack another one. It's getting hard to do. Let's go 50 grand. Bring it on, baby. I'll get up on the roof and start dancing. Get down to 25 grand. I'll start taking my clothes off. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's probably why I would do it. Bitcoin is a different type of prep than we've been talking about today. We're talking about prepping for disaster. Bitcoin is preparing for your own future, and your children's future, and your grandchildren's future. It's generational wealth. And so we have to think about it differently. That's my answer. That answer is, I don't know where the bottom is, and I don't. Normally, this time in a cycle, I would tell you, I'm pretty damn sure what's about to happen. The world has changed. You have the most powerful financial regulators on the planet in the U.S. government openly advocating for Bitcoin and going to and speaking at, like, you know, Bitcoin events. We have never had anything like that before. We have banks being told it's okay to custody Bitcoin. We have banks being told, yes, you can look at the Bitcoin a person holds as assets that they have available when you're preparing, when you're approving them for a mortgage that's an FHA or VA mortgage. We've never had anything like that. I'm going to answer this one and I'm going to wrap up. Gifted Dewey says, are you still recommending Strike is your platform to purchase Bitcoin daily? It is a platform I recommend, and it is the one that I use. I don't really care what you use. I like Strike. I personally like Jack Maulers. I believe he's exactly who he presents himself to be. I like River, but I don't really know anything about the person that owns it. I have confidence in the person and the platform both. But this is why I don't care where you buy, right? As long as you're not getting ripped off on fees or spreads, it doesn't matter, because this is what I recommend you do, what I do. I always try to do that. Recommending you do something I don't do is disingenuous. Set a number because of how I buy. Cause sometimes I buy, you know, sometimes like, wow, I really went down. Here's $300 more. Right? When I hit about $1,000 USD value, roughly that number actually has changed too. When I hit 1,000,000 sats, I withdraw it to self-custody. So there's never more than 999,000 sats sitting on any place that I buy Bitcoin. I do that to keep the transfer fees down, and then they move on to a soft wallet. And when that balance on that soft wallet gets up to a significant amount of combined withdrawals and payments from people and things like that, then that all gets moved onto cold storage, and those get combined to a single UTXO for long-term expense management. And so that's what I recommend you do. Now, do I recommend that you do it with Strike? Absolutely, I recommend that you do it. But if you tell me you're using River or Block or fucking PayPal for all that I care, I don't care. As long as you don't, like, if you're sitting with like 15, 20 grand on an exchange and you do not self-custody, then I'm going to tell you that you're wrong, unless the reason you have that much or a lot more being custodied is because it's inside like a 401 or IRA or something, and you buy an ETF. That's different. That's different. If you actually own real Bitcoin, or you own the individual Bitcoin, then I highly recommend that you self-custody it, because it just eliminates a variable, which is the government can decide you don't need it anymore. Because if somebody says they're going to take my Bitcoin, good fucking luck. So what you're telling me there is you're going to pick the right atom out of the known universe to take, because I'm not giving it to you. So that's why I don't really worry. We're not going to turn this into a Bitcoin breakout, but I'm going to do this one and I'm going to move on. Can you still mine Bitcoin with a home computer that has Bitcoin? No, you can't. Not in any meaningful way. You can mine from home, but not with a laptop or your gaming computer in any meaningful way. You need to be looking at ASICs at this point, which is a computer designed to do nothing but mine Bitcoin. All right, let's wrap up real quick. I want to remind you that Joel Riles, and he did text me right in the middle of this, and I didn't read it. She may be gone. I don't know, but he has a breeder Malinois that is a beautiful girl. This is a wonderful dog. She's about 6 years old. She is fully protection trained. She produced and raised a bunch of wonderful puppies. And she is a great dog with some good years left in her. And she is for sale at a fraction of what you would pay for, let's say, a three-year-old fully trained dog that's being delivered as a protection dog. That can cost you up to $75,000. Right. So it's kind of like buying a really great used car, except it's biological. Anyway, this girl is great. And at six, stable as the day is long, man. She'd be a great dog. So if you're interested in that, just go by the website, scroll down, and there's an email address in there to email Joel and let him know you're interested. And if he tells you she's gone, see what else he has available. Because I know he's got some pups available right now at a pretty good deal and some other things going on. But God, I wish I could take this girl. I'd buy her. I can't have a three dog household anymore. I'm down to a two dog household. That's what works for me. And just that's, you know, lifestyle design. Even though I want it, I'm not going to do it. Next up on lifestyle design, if you like the way I talk and the way I teach, you're probably going to like my book, Laws of Life. It's on sale for the holidays. You can find that at Amazon. Just look for Laws of Life, Jack Spierko, or go to the website and you can go through my links and I'll make a couple extra pennies when you do that. But this would make a great gift for the young people in your life. And last but not least, if you do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com, that's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com, you'll help me out no matter what you buy. I'm still running these Merton and Stork carbon steel skillets. Man, I'm going to tell you, if you're a cook like me and you want really great, super high quality cookware, this German made carbon steel line of skillets is fucking awesome. Just like super high end. And you know what? They cost about the same as a dadgone Lodge. Any given day, the same size skillet between Lodge and Merton and Stork, $2 to $3 difference. And it might be the Lodge is actually more or a little bit less. It just, you know, prices go variable. These things are beautifully milled, perfectly smooth, flat as well. Lodges a lot of times and other carbon steel skillets have a little bit of that high spot in the center. It's kind of annoying. Wonderful handles, top quality rivets, everything steel. So it can go from the burner into the broiler and back to the burner. It's something to protect your hands because you burn the shit out of yourself if you don't do it right. The walls are, the side walls are just a little higher and a little steeper for tossing things and for cooking and for not having shit jump out and go down into the stove burner and all. Better for that. Better all around, same price. If you love to cook, get yourself one, two, three, however many you want. And if you have a foodie or a cook in your life who wants really high quality gear, get them this. It will blow them away. It is such high quality. With that, I am ready to wrap up and goodbye until December. Santa Jack will return on the 1st of December. I also want to remind you the AI solo course that you can register for at jackslaws.com, which goes along with the book. The AI solopreneur course is going to go on sale on, it's like the 21st of December. Let me, again, I don't want to lie to you. Let me get that right. So that's November, December 22nd, Monday the 22nd, right before we go away for Christmas. We're dropping it then, and then it will actually start, instead of 1 week out from that, 2 weeks out, because we've got the Christmas holiday, so that will be Monday, January 5th. The course will actually begin. It is going to sell out in minutes. How do I know that? Because the last one sold out in 1 minute and 45 freaking seconds, and the first course we put on sale broke the damn server because we didn't do whatever Tom did to fix that from happening again. We have over 800 people, close to 900 people pre-registered. If you are not pre-registered, you're not going to get an email on the morning of the 24th. If you get that email, it's going to give you a link. And when you click it and go to it, it's going to be a countdown on it. So you get like 15 minutes before it actually goes to zero. We're going to send that email to make it a little less of a break your neck to get be ready. And then when it hits zero, it's a race. And once 100 seats are sold, it's gone until the next round. We're going to run 5 rounds next year if we can, at least 4. That's 400 people. There's over 800 people free. You see what I'm saying? This course is white hot because it works. Talk to people who have taken it already. Get into the chats on Telegram and talk to people in the alumni group, especially if you're in the alumni group, that have taken the course, and ask them what it's done for their business. And you'll find out why people are this excited about taking it. So I just wanted to mention that. And otherwise, I'm gone. Tomorrow you get the Thanksgiving special. I wish you the best for your holiday, and I will see you on Monday when we come back December the 1st. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.